This will be the 8-month agony of Cesar Chavez. Bustos asked, he used to be an organizer for the CSO, didn't he? Yes, he did, I said. And what an organizer. Possibly one of the best organizers that ever lived. And I began to tell them the story of Caesar's 8-month ordeal when he first came into the valley. He had no well thought out, well conceived idea of what it was he was going to do when he first came in. He knew that he wasn't going to, he didn't know exactly how he was going to, he had a lot of ideas, but he didn't know exactly how he was going to put the whole thing together. He didn't have a real program. But he knew that he was not going to do it the way previous organizers had tried to do it, by coming in after the workers had struck and then organizing them around that big issue, or starting the strike and organizing, using the strike as the issue, because that had always failed. Without fail, it had always failed. And, of course, by that time, he'd been organizing for 8 solid years, so he knew he could organize. And so I think that part of his plan was all clear in his mind. He just didn't really know, though, how all the pieces were going to fit together. And another thing that he had made up his mind on from the very beginning was he was determined that if the workers wanted a...
How did you check the volume?
Yeah. He was determined that if the workers wanted an organization, they were going to have to want it badly enough to pay for it themselves. He absolutely refused to accept big donations. There was some big Democrat that was going to give him money to go out, and he refused it because he knew there'd be strings attached to it. And not only that, but the workers wouldn't trust him if he came in there, you know, all loaded with money. And yet he also knew that unless the workers put their own hard-earned dough into that organization, they'd never feel like it was theirs. It was always going to be somebody else's organization, in which they wouldn't give a damn about, you know. That was one of the ideas that he was going to cleave to right from the beginning. But that also, in turn, presented a big problem. Because in order to get the workers to support him and his family while he was organizing the union or the association, he had to get at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And he only had a little money to eat on for him and his family, and only a little money for gasoline to get around to all of these workers. So that was the big problem. How in the hell was he ever going to be able to do this fast enough before he ran out of money in order to get all these people together to support him and his wife and family and pay for the gas before he ran out of the little money that he had saved up from working with the CSO?
How many kids did he have?
8. 8 kids. So that was the big problem that he was confronted with right from the very beginning, among many others that he didn't even think about it at the beginning.
How much money did he have saved up?
He had about $1,200. That was to make a payment on that was supposed to be, Helen had been saving that out of his CSO salary to make a payment, a down payment on a house that they were someday going to buy, you know. Well, they never got a house. So in any case, in early April of 1962, he and the kids and Helen drove into Delano, and the first thing they did was to go around and talk to some of the relatives. Both Caesar and Helen had relatives there in Delano, and then there were, you know, a few friends that he and Richard had grown up with, you know, hung around with while they were growing up. And to sort of, sound them out a little bit, he didn't go into it too much, but he sounded them out, told them that he was going to try to organize the farm workers, and he didn't know how he was going to do it yet, but that he was going to need some help from them. He knew that, and that was about it. He really didn't go into it very deeply at that time. They were, of course, willing to give him a little help. They didn't have very much themselves, but they're willing to give him a little bit. So then he began, after about 2 weeks of feeling his way around in Delano there, talking to the people, some of his old friends, he decided that he was going to make a sweep through the valley, and he started down there at Wheeler Ridge on the east side of the valley, and he went through all the little towns and barrios clear up to Atwater, which is up near Stockton, you know. And then he turned around and came back on the west side of the valley and through all the little towns over there.
What kind of people was he talking to?
Talking to farm workers, for the most part, and also some old-time CSO leaders, or people that had been the CSO, or inactive farm workers that had belonged to CSO at one time, and had dropped out, or were still in it, just feeling them out a little bit, you know, about what they thought. And not going into it too deeply, because his main job, the main thing he was trying to do was to just get a real feel of the valley into his bones, you know, and to see just how big this monster really was. He had worked practically every inch of it, so he knew it, but he just wanted to live all through it, relive it, you know. And while he was doing this, though, every once in a while he'd spot some workers who were fairly near the road, and he'd stop his car and get out and talk to them. And it was then that, after he'd done that a few times, that, you know, he'd ask them how much they were getting and how, you know, how it was going, and, you know, chew the fat with them. And it was then that he got the idea that he ought to be getting their names and addresses, not just talking to them. And so then he...
How did he identify himself?
Yeah, that he had been working in other parts of the state, and he just wanted to find out how the things were going down here, how much they were making here, what they were paying, and so forth, and how the conditions were in the field. And so then he decided that he was going to get the names and addresses of as many of the most interested people as he possibly could. So that's when he hit on the idea of the farm worker census, or what was also known as the voto popular, or the popular vote. And that, what that amounted to, actually two things: a leaflet and a postcard. And the leaflet asked the worker, it told him that this was a popular vote among the workers, that the workers had never had a chance to really vote, to vote on how much they thought they ought to get as a minimum wage. Other people had always decided what the workers' wages should be. The workers had never had a chance to decide themselves.
Do you have that leaflet?
No. And I couldn't get a copy of it. And so what he was trying to do was to, he was making this census to find out what the workers themselves really thought. And he wasn't making any big promises, you know, that, or he said this in the leaflet, that without making any big promises, that this was going to lead to a big and immediate raise in salaries and so forth, but that someday, on the basis of something like this or something like it, that legislation might be passed to determine a minimum wage. And then on he had the postcard, which they could. There was a place on the postcard which said how much I think that I should get, so much, you know, space per hour, or if it were they're working on piece rates, so much per contract, and so forth. And then they'd sign a name, place for the name and address, and send it into the, it was a self-addressed thing. And they just put it in the postcard. In Spanish, because they were all Spanish. And they're all Mexican. And then if they thought it was a good thing, why, they'd send it in.
They had to put on their own stamp?
No, it was stamped, too. That's where, you know, the money went.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be for food for the Chavez family. Yeah. Well, he did this. He just started doing this in the beginning, just in the little towns right around Delano. So he got up there in April, and the kids had to go to school, and so they had to work right around Delano. He wanted eventually during the summer vacation to take the whole family out and to get their help.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked part time in the field too, in the peas and in the suckering grapes. And Helen got a full-time job back at DiGiorgio. She used to work for DiGiorgio in the old days before they ever got married, so she got her job back there. And then, even before school let out, though, Caesar began organizing in the towns right around Delano, and he started with these same little cards, you know, which he hadn't mimeographed in any large numbers yet, or the leaf was either just in small numbers on a hand crank mimeograph machine in his own house that he got from the club that Richard belonged to, the Club Ideal, and he just mimeographed enough to last a couple days, you know. Then he'd go back and mimeograph some more ground. Well, he started out in Bakersfield, the actual organizing. Well, he doesn't refer to it as organizing later on. It was really what he calls preliminary work, but of course it's all part and parcel of the same thing. He got some help from some of the old CSO members down there to call together a few of the farm workers, you know, that they knew or who had belonged to the CSO in the old days and so forth. And in the beginning, it was very, very hard to get the farm workers together. They were very frightened of anything that had to do with any discussion about farm work, because they had been beaten so terribly, you know, in the Georgia strike in 1948 and in other strikes, the cotton strikes and all the rest of them. Had always been horrible defeats and killings and all that in the past. So in the beginning, the first house meeting he held there, and he went, and there was nobody there. Nobody had showed up at all. So he and Dave, whoever it was that held the house meeting, went out and very gently urged the people that were living right around there that were supposed to come, to come. And well, they wanted him to tell them right then, why should they come over? What is it, Senor Chavez, that you want to talk to us about? And he said, well, I've got some ideas, and I'd like to have a little chat with you. Well, tell us right now. Well, no, there's somebody waiting for us back there, and so we can't take the time now. He'll come on over. So, you know, it was that kind of an ordeal to even get them to listen. It wasn't like the CSO, you see. The CSO was highly respectable as compared with this, because they were afraid if they got caught in that kind of a meeting, they'd be blackballed. They'd lose their jobs. They were that frightened when he first started organizing. And so he'd start, like I said, in that other thing. But we all know that we don't get paid very much for our work, and we all know that we all know about the contractors, but the way they treat our wives, and sometimes in addition, and you know, make the wives go to the toilet out there on the vines, and sometimes the wives even have to sell their bodies to the contractors to get a decent job. And we all know how we have to pass the hat every time there's somebody dies because they don't have enough money to bury them. We all know what happens in the wintertime when there aren't any jobs and we have to borrow money from the contractor or the grower. We say we borrow $10 and we have to pay 50% or 80% interest on it. And we all know these things, and they all nod their heads and so forth. And, of course, he would start out by saying, I'm Cesar Chavez from Delano, and I'm with the National Farm Workers Association, because that's another thing he had decided on was the name. He was going to have to use some kind of a name. I'm with the National Farm Workers Association, and I would like to talk to you. Just, you know, I have some ideas about, you know, about farm work, and he wouldn't talk about organizing. He found out right away that he shouldn't be talking about that, because right away they didn't want to hear any more about that. And so he would talk, though, as soon as he found out that they didn't want to talk about wages, for instance. That was one of the other things they didn't want to talk about. So, not in the beginning, anyway. They'd want to talk, they found out that they'd talk about these other things, you know, these other little issues that I just mentioned to you, and that would start opening them up, and how they all had to borrow money, and those goddamn contractors, and so that's true what they do to our women and all that, and they have no respect, and we live in indignity, a state of constant indignity, and then he would, though, finally, this he had to learn the hard way, because he started out with the wages first and didn't want to. But then, after he talked about all these other things and about the family, he had Bertie with him. Bertie was the only kid that wasn't going to school. He was only 4 years old. He'd take Bertie along with him, and he used to teach him the various crops, and they had a game as they drove along, and Cesar taught him, you know, well, almost all of it was cotton, and so pretty quick Bertie thought everything was cotton. But he would start out in the morning, and one of his relatives there would prepare a little lunch for him and put in an apple for Bertie, so that Cesar wouldn't have to spend money, his cigarette money, to buy Bertie his lunch. And that's how they got their lunch every day. And Cesar got his cigarettes. In those days, he was quite a smoker. Well, anyway, back to the house meeting. He'd start talking about he would gradually lead up to the point that so much of what we've been talking about seems to revolve around wages, you know. And it seems to me, at least, that maybe it's because that maybe so much of our troubles are because of the fact that we're getting such slow wages. Well, by that time, you know, they were, you know, he'd sort of led them around to that point, and they, well, yeah, that's probably it, all right. And so he'd say, well, how much do you think you ought to, he said, I'm sort of conducting a census, a workers' a popular vote, and he'd show them this thing. He'd show them the leaflet, and he wouldn't show it to them up until that point. He'd show it to them then. How much do you think you ought to get? And they'd all look at each other, and nobody'd say anything. Finally, one of them would say, well, what do you think? How much do you think we ought to get? And in the beginning, he'd say, well, I don't know, maybe $1.60, $2, right away. He wouldn't want to discuss it anymore. And so then he realized what a big boo-boo he'd committed, you know. Well, he'd say, how much do you think you ought to get? Well, he'd say, well, maybe, well, maybe $1.20. This was very discouraging to him at first, because at first he thought that that they just really didn't understand the wealth of the big growers. They thought that, you know, they couldn't afford to pay him anymore. And then it suddenly hit him, well, hell, they're right. They're practical. I'm the dreamer, you know. They know that it's not going to be humanly possible for them to get $1.60 or $2 for God knows how long, and that the very most they can expect to get would be a raise from $1.10 to $1.20. That's how. So then Caesar asked them, well, how do you think we're ever going to be able to raise it up to $1.20 from $1.10? And they just sort of shrugged and shook their heads, and they were you know, just in from the fields anyway, and they looked older than they really were, because they were so damn beat and tired, you know, and they just didn't come up with any answers. And so Caesar said, well, you know that you can't get it by going and asking the boss. Have any of you, I'm sure you've tried that. Oh, yeah, they all nodded. They tried that, but in years past, it didn't do any good. And so he said, but what do you think might happen if a lot of us got together in one association, like the Farm Workers Association that I've been telling you about? And, well, we all, you know, went and asked them together. Well, I thought maybe there might be something to that. But then one of them said to this business about, well, it's a good idea, Mr. Chavez, but it won't work. And he said, why? He said, well, they're just too powerful. What do you mean powerful? Well, they just got too much money. How can we stand up against all that money? And so then Caesar said, well, but can a grower get his grapes picked with a $10 bill or a $50 bill or a $100 bill or a $1,000 bill? And each time they said, no. He said, well, what can he get it picked with? And they all held out their hands, you know, by us. So he said, well, what do you think would happen if some morning all of those hands weren't out there picking the grapes? Oh, and one of them said, oh, that would never happen, Mr. Chavez. Oh, no, that never. The workers would be afraid to do that. Oh, he said, oh, I know it won't ever happen. But just for the sake of argument, just supposing that it did, that nobody showed up out there. Oh, but it won't happen. And he says, I know it won't. It isn't going to happen yet. But what if it does happen someday? What if someday they get organized? Oh, then he said, yeah, then it will. And when Caesar reached this point, he could always tell that he could tell that they were uneasy. And so he'd, in order to let him off a little easy, he'd always let them know that he didn't expect everybody in that room to become part of the association. He wasn't asking that. He wasn't asking them to become members of anything or to pay dues. And what he was letting them know was that, what he did let them know was that maybe if he could just find one out of 100 in Bakersfield that would be willing to move, and was not afraid, was a real man, then that's all he could expect. That's all he expected.
He used these terms?
Yeah. And they'd always want to know, well, the other thing they always wanted, what they wanted to know was, don't. Then they asked him, well, who's backing you? Is the CIO backing you? No, he said, no, the CIO isn't backing. They probably don't even know we're in existence. He said, they said, well, is the Chamber of Commerce backing you? He said, no, Lord, no, they're tied in with the growers, you know. Chamber of Commerce, because they used to have to go to the Chamber of Commerce to get licenses to put on their Cinco de Mayo and their 16th of September celebrations, you see. And so they said, well, then who is backing you? And he says, well, nobody except some farm workers. And, of course, I'm backing myself and maybe some of you.
How clearly would the Farm Workers Association was just a one-man deal?
Oh, he didn't go into that. Yeah. He just, you know, because it wasn't a one-man deal after he had the first meeting, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, you see, at this time, in the very beginning, all he was trying to do was to find or to kindle a little tiny bit of hope, you know. As I said, he wasn't trying to get them to join anything. Or, God, that, you know, it was almost impossible to kindle the hope. And it would have been twice as hard to get any dues and absolutely impossible, I mean, you know, to get them to become members and get dues. And so just that was just completely out of the question. And so that in the beginning, that's all he was after, was to feel them out and see if he could arouse them. And of course, he was using everything he had to arouse them, to show them that there was a little bit of hope, you know, to get that little bit of hope kindled in them.
And he was using the meetings mainly as a way of just meeting large numbers of people to find a couple of hard workers.
Well, just he was with meeting with just tiny groups of people. You know,
yeah.
A tiny group here and then a tiny group there. And, you know, maybe sometimes he'd work in the beginning. As I say, he had to work a whole week, you know, to get to just a tiny group. And then he had to go out and just gradually bring them into the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but at the end of the meeting, as they were beginning to file out, and most of them, there was one guy that stayed behind and said, well, it's true, Senor Chavez, it's a very good idea, but it isn't going to work. They're just too powerful. And, of course, that let Caesar way down, you know, because he knew that that guy was reflecting the opinion of probably everybody else that was there.
Mm.
You know, maybe there was one who hadn't spoken up, because usually the ones who do believe don't speak up. They're the silent ones, you know. And later on you find out that they do believe. But this fellow was probably just echoing the sentiments of the rest of them. But gradually he got to the point, by working and working and working, of holding as many as one meeting a night, and usually at least two on Sunday. In that Bakersfield, in the lower part of the valley, you know, and talking to the people and getting them to take more and more of the little leaflets and the cards to distribute among their fellow workers out at work. See, this was one of the things that he was trying to do.
Was he working at all right now?
Just part-time, in order to get money for gasoline, you see.
Right.
That was his main. And this was the other thing that was, see, here was all this tremendous opposition and fear on the part of the workers. The other thing was this constant state of semi-hunger and of not having any money or hardly any money, you know. So that every time he got in the car, he was worried. Oh God, this is going to cost. It's probably going to cost me a dollar and a half to go between here and Bakersfield and back, and I haven't got that much hardly. I just barely got that much, you know, to spare for it, and I can't go any further because I just won't have the money. And it was at this time too, then, that he actually began to go around to his various friends, his old-time buddies that I mentioned before, and relatives, and put the crunch on him a little bit, including Richard, you know, and to begin to get a little bit of help from them in the way of food. And he also began to talk to the people who were on relief, to ask them, you know, if there's anything that you don't like that you get from the surplus commodities, well, you know, the Chavez family can always use it, you know. Mm-hmm. Stuff that Mexican people don't like Graham flour, you know, and bran flour, and, I don't know what else, but, pork and beans, for instance, which is not a Mexican dish, and things like that. And so every once in a while, somebody on relief would bring it to him. And then he started also talking to people that he knew were working in the corn and asking them to bring, you know, ears of corn into the family, or that were working in the potatoes and asking them to bring potatoes, you know, culled potatoes into the Chavez family. Because, and that was what they were living on. You know, they had to have that kind of help. And it was his next big drive was over in Corcoran, which is quite a ways from Delano, north and slightly west. And he knew a family over in there, Julio and Tino Hernandez. So they were old-time CSO members. So they agreed to call a few people together. And Caesar made his pitch, and by that time he had it pretty well developed, you know, because he'd held a number of house meetings in Bakersfield and in and around Delano and so forth, and he was gradually beginning to move up the valley. And Tina kept asking him every once in a while during the meeting, "Do you really think it can be done? Really think it can be done?" He says, I don't just think it can be done. I know it can be done. He said, I have actually seen it done. And then he told him a little bit about the work that he'd already done over in Oxnard, where he had begun to organize the farm workers. So he knew it could be done, you know, and how they had stood up against the growers over there and against the whole state apparatus of the Farm Placement Service and gotten ahead of it, fired and all that. And so, you know, this meant something, but not enough. It was, you know, it was, they still weren't completely satisfied. And he could tell as he was leaving, just as he was going out the door, Tina was out in the kitchen, was cleaning up the kitchen, and he noticed a big plate of chicken, fried chicken, that was on top of the refrigerator. And so he was very hungry, and it was long drive back to Delano, and but he went out and got in his car, and he started it, and he kept thinking about that chicken, and the more he thought of it, the hungrier he got, and so he finally made up his mind he was going to go back and somehow get some of that chicken. So he turned off the motor and went back to the house. He just started up the back steps when he heard him talking through the rear window about, well, that crazy little nut thinks he's going to organize the farm workers, you know, and he thinks he's going to beat the growers. What a nut, one of them was saying. And so he got away from there right quick, and he waited another 5 minutes because he didn't want them to think he heard what they said. And then he came back and knocked on, "Oh, hello, Caesar. Did you forget something?" And he said, "Yeah, I think I left my ballpoint in here." And so he came in, and the chicken was still up on top of the. And as he went through the kitchen, he finally broke down enough pride to be able to say, "Gee, that chicken sure looks good. Oh, would you like some?" she said. "Man, I sure would. I haven't had anything to eat since the beans I had for breakfast this morning." So right in front of all these people, you know, he had about 8 or 10 people there. He sat down and ate the chicken. And this, up until then, they didn't know, but, well, you know, some of them thought, well, he's probably some shyster of some kind, you know, trying to lead us down the line, and what does he really care about the poor people and the farm workers and all that? But, God, the way he ate that chicken, that proved to them, you know, that he was really, that they were poor, but that he was really poorer than any of them. And so, without having planned it that way at all, he turned a liability, his hunger, into an asset. Because right while he was eating that chicken, he began to talk to him about something that they could do right then, which was to take a good supply of these cards and leaflets and go around and convert the farm workers in Corcoran. And they did. And they did one of the best jobs in the whole valley. He put them right to work, just like that, all of them. All of them got sold on him just because, well, you know, and he had something for him to do right now, and he went out and did it. He just during the meeting, none of them really caught fire, and he could tell that they were, he gave them a few, you know, but he didn't, just for them to, but during the meeting, they began to really get turned on, and, you know, and so, this was just I've talked about the opposition to him of the farm workers themselves, you know, along the lines that I've mentioned. Now I'm talking about another oppressive problem that he had during that time, and that's this problem of no money and of hunger that he was constantly faced with, you know. And yet people wouldn't believe it, you know. He would, one night he went into one of the barracks at one of the labor camps in Delano there to talk to the workers. And of course, most of them were young guys, and they were getting ready to go out. It was a Friday night. But a couple of the older guys were listening to him and talking to him and so forth. And finally, one of them said, well, how much do you get for this? This happened to be one of the immigrant people that come in from Mexico every year, you know. And they're more suspicious, and they figured there was a gimmick, you know. So they said, "What do they pay you to do this?" And Caesar said, "They don't pay me anything. I don't get anything." And right away, he heard some of these young bucks snickering, you know, as though, "Oh God, what a liar," you know, and so forth. And so he. After he left, he got thinking how in the old days when he worked for CSO, how he hated that question. People would say, well, how much do you get to do this? And he'd have to tell them, you know, well, I get this. They pay me to do it. And he used to hate to have to do that, you know, because, well, he wanted to be just like they were and so forth. And now it was just the reverse. He hated to have to tell them that he wasn't getting paid anything, because they didn't believe him, you know. And on top of all that, he was so damn hungry at the time he was telling them this, you know. That made it even worse, you know, to be telling them that he wasn't getting any money, and then to have him laugh at him right in his face practically when he was just, you know, not starving, but really hungry, you know. It was really, insult added to injury, you know. He gradually developed a technique whereby he would tell them that, he did get it a little bit, just enough to eat on, and that's all. And he found that was much easier for him to accept than to say, I don't get anything, because that was completely outside their experience. Nobody would do it. And so they didn't believe him. But when he said, you know, well, I get enough to live on, and that's all, to feed my family, and that's all I get. And then, that made sense, you know. Whereas that first time with Tina and Julio Hernandez, he hadn't, there was nothing of guile or strategy or anything involved in asking for it. Gradually, he began to use that because he was always hungry, you know. And at the end of the day, he wouldn't be able to get anything. He drove clear home from maybe 50, 60 miles from where he was. And he did, because he didn't have the money to spend to buy, you know, hot dogs and all that along the road. And so he gradually started to, as he was calling on maybe the last person of the day, they'd be eating. And he got to the point where he would ask if, he would tell them that, gee, that sure looks good, or that sure, that a little hot coffee would sure go good right now. And so then they invite him to eat, you know. And that gave him a chance to talk. And the thing that he found out, of course, was that although what was that that when somebody gives you something, when somebody does something for you, it establishes a much stronger bond than when you give something to somebody else. And he hadn't known that before. It had always been the other way, you know. He was always giving, giving, giving. But when somebody gives you something, you know, that really means something. And so from that time on, he didn't hesitate at all. He just tossed his pride aside and went ahead and asked for food. Of course, it was during this period, after he'd been working for about 4 or 5 months, that all the Chavez kids broke out in little sores from malnutrition. They weren't getting enough of the right kind of food because he was having to spend too much money on gasoline. So he couldn't buy the right kind of food, and that was what was happening. During this period, of course, he told Helen that, you know, they were going to be going through hell and that they would never have any private life from the time that he began to get into the workers and they would trust him and he began to work on their problems. They just beat a path through that house day and night. They had no private life at all. Or maybe after 12 o'clock or something at night. But otherwise, the house was always full of people, full of workers bringing their problems to Caesar. Usually problems involving workman's compensation, disability insurance, or back wages that the growers owed them, or something, you know, like that. And then he'd have to, you know, work on them because, well, he was there and he was organizing them, and that was an organizing tool. And but then on top of that problem was another problem which had to do with the old time friends of his and some of his relatives who would get Richard aside and say, hey, what's the matter with your brother? Is he off his rocker or what? What's all this crazy stuff of tearing up and down the valley talking to the workers and all that, you know? Why doesn't he get a job and go to work, you know? So they had no understanding of what it was, although he had tried to explain it to them. And on top of that was the attitude, naturally, of the labor contractors. One night he was in People's Cafe down there, you know, and he was talking to somebody in there, and the guy asked him, what he was doing this for, and he tried to explain it to him, and he heard somebody snickering, and it was one of these contractors. And so pretty quick he left, and Richard was still there, though. And the contractors began ha-haing among themselves and saying, yeah, that Caesar got thrown out of the CSO for stealing money, and so... he feels he's got to have an organization, so he's trying to build his own organization so he can steal the money from the farm workers. And, of course, right away, Richard and some of the farm workers that were in there said, well, even if He said, he doesn't do that. He isn't doing that. But even if he did, he wouldn't be spending any, wouldn't be stealing anywhere near as much money from the farm workers as you bastards are every day being labor contractors, you know, and taking the money away from them and bleeding them white. So that was the end of that little episode. But that was another force of opposition. And about the same time, AWOC came to town, the Agriculture Workers Organizing Committee of LCIO. They heard that he was active. They didn't know what the hell he was doing. But their organizers started following him around in the towns where he was working and trying to disrupt the meetings that he was holding. And they had one loudmouth woman by the name of Maria Moreno, who was especially loudmouth and who was constantly running him and the NFWA down. But the more that they do it, the more they were actually working against themselves, because Caesar had already been there and talked to the people. He hadn't tried to get any of their money. He hadn't tried to get anything from them except some hope. Whereas these other guys had been trying to get their money. So right away, of course, this worked in his favor. And you probably read that part about the organizer that came out with his little dog, Tiger, and was teaching him, not to wet the car and not to crap in the car and all that. That was the kind of an organizer that he was. But they were constantly trying to turn the people against Caesar, you know. And then another big obstacle he had to fight was actually himself, because every time that he would come away from one of these meetings discouraged, I mean, after a meeting, and he felt that he hadn't gotten very far, or maybe hadn't gotten anywhere, you know, he would feel very low. And when he couldn't get too many meetings during a week at the very beginning, he was feeling very low, very low. Because he was constantly comparing it with his production record in CSO, you know, which was 1, 2, 3, go, 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 you know, and you could really move. And he couldn't do that with the farm workers. It was a much, much slower thing, and he had seen what happened to organizers who did get discouraged, you know, who became discouraged and then disillusioned and then cynical, to the point where they actually expected defeat, and so that they wouldn't be let down and disillusioned because they expected it, you know. And so it was like they were having a competition to see how many house meetings they couldn't have, you know. He was damned if he was ever going to let himself get in that. But he was worried that he might. He'd seen it happen, you know, so have I. And they'd all find all kinds of excuses, you know, for not having the house meetings, you know, and all that. Not being able to do it. And he was damned if he was going to let that happen. And so he just gave himself twice as much time plus as he would have had it been a CSO operation, you know. That was a gimmick that did help him a little. His amount of expectation was cut about in half, you know, as compared with what it had been. After school was out during summer vacation, the whole family became part of the organizing operation, and they would start out early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, and go out and work in the peas or whatever it was until 10 o'clock, and then they'd fill up their water bottles and they'd have their tacos or whatever it was, their food and blankets and so forth for the kids to lie on in the back of the old Mercury station wagon, and they'd take off for the towns that were much further away from Delano. They'd go up into towns like Reedley and Sanger and Mendota and Fireball and all of those towns around there up in Fresno County, because they'd already covered the towns in Kern and Tulare. But now they had the whole day, and each day that they went a little further, they would have to start out a little earlier, you know, so that as they got further and further away from Delano, they would be able to work less and less out in the fields. And Caesar, as I mentioned, I don't know whether I mentioned, but he did work in both in the grapes and in the cotton. Helen worked in the cotton too, and in the peas. And they had a walkout in the peas. There was, you know, a spontaneous strike, but Caesar didn't try to make anything of it because he knew it would would be harmful for him to get involved in anything like that. Now he was saving all that for the future. But wherever he would go and wherever he was working, he was making these, kind of bitter little remarks, you know, like I mentioned to you about the drinking water being so hot you could drop a few peas in it and have pea soup, or it was so hot that it would kill all the worms that were in the water. So it was pure water anyway, even if it was hot. And that actually the amount of money that they made during the day barely paid for the gasoline to get them out there and back, you know, and this sort of thing. But as they, during the summer then, they began to go further and further afield. And but still as they went along the highway, Caesar would send the kids out if they saw workers near the highway and pass out the cards and the leaflets for them. And then they would go to a town, say a town like Sanger, and while Helen and the kids passed out the leaflets from door to door, just the leaflets, they went through with the leaflets through the whole barrio. Caesar would go and see the priest, for instance, and get the priest to take him to some people, some farm workers that the priest knew, who he thought might be interested, and then Caesar would have maybe a meeting of 10 or 15, and out of that, narrow it down to a second meeting, a smaller meeting of the people who would really be willing to become a committee for that little town. He would get that either through the priest or by standing in front of a grocery store as the workers were coming in from work, and begin to talk to them as they came out of the store or went into the store about and show them the census and see whether or not they were interested in coming to a meeting there. Or else he would just be driving along and he'd see a group of people around a car after dinner, you know, and he'd stop the car and go over and talk to them and show them the leaflets and see if they were interested, and then try and get them to come to the little meeting that he was going to call to explain the whole thing to them, you know. And he had many, many disappointments. He hates to go to towns like Reedley and the one right next to it, I forget, Parlier. He just hates those towns. He wants to get away from them as soon as he can, because both he and Manuel and the priest and some girls from one of the Catholic schools up here worked for 12 days toward a meeting, and only three people came to that meeting. Wow. And he was just so upset about that. As a matter of fact, I happened to be at that meeting. I was in the valley at the time. And I forgot to tell you, also used to have Social Security material in Spanish, which he would always take to give to the workers. They didn't know a damn thing about Social Security, and this was all in Spanish, and he'd pass it out as a, you know, free service to them to show them what they were entitled to. And after this meeting, where only three showed up, he rushed out and tried to make up for having had a horrible failure, you know. And he heard that there were some young bucks out at the river there. So he rushed out there and started talking to them and was so anxious to compensate for this thing that he oversold himself to the young guys. And he made a a date for them to meet with him, not one of them, for the next day, because they were out swimming. They didn't want to talk about it right then, but they'd come back. Not one of them showed up, but there was an old man there fishing. So Caesar talked to him for about 2 hours and got him sold, and he became the chairman of the committee in Parlier. So they finally got somebody in Parlier. But he was beginning to rush it too much as he was running out of money. He knew he had...
This was around what month?
This was around August, July and August. And he had set September 30th as the day on which he was going to call a valley-wide meeting of all of the committee people that he had organized all during the past 8 years, that he and Dolores... Dolores had been involved in this too, and so had Manuel. Manuel had come to live with him, and he had become involved in it. Dolores was working the upper part of the valley from Stockton on Lodi in Sacramento, and Manuel was working down there with Caesar. So he was shooting for that date to call them all together to actually set up the permanent National Farm Workers Organization. And to think about a constitution, bylaws, and probably get some advice from the workers, suggestions from the workers about what ought to go in that, and also about program that they wanted. He had been picking up a great deal of information about the kind of programs that he wanted, because that was part of his pitch. You know, these various things that he brought up all led toward certain programs. I mentioned before that when he was talking about the lack of work during the winter time, you know, then, well, there's the possibility of a credit union, having the workers having a credit union. And the fact that when they died, no insurance or anything to bury them, well, then maybe they needed a burial fund, a very inexpensive burial fund. Talk about the contractors, beating them white, well, let's get rid of them. Maybe we can get rid of them and have our own hiring hall, make the growers hire through our own hiring hall instead of going through the damn contractors that lead us white, you know. So they'd already talked about these things, and many of them had them in their minds, you know, because they had talked about them at the various house meetings and committee meetings. And so he figured that was those would be brought up at the big meeting that they had in September. So he was rushing to finish the initial work of getting out all of the leaflets and postcards so that he could make one more swing around to remind everybody personally about the big meeting that was coming up in September. So he began to rush it too fast. And that was what was happening there in Parlier and Reedley. He was rushing it too much. And it happened over in Mendota and Fireball. He was rushing it too much, and the people weren't coming out to the meetings, and he was getting very, very discouraged and suffering a great deal because he could see the thing beginning to... And then he began to realize what he was doing, and he slowed down and decided not to continue trying anymore with the leaflets and the postcards, but to make the big swing around to get as many of them as he could out to the meeting. And... of course, he had another very cute little idea that he sprang on them, which was for them to open up their own mailbox, their own what do you call it, PO box, uh-huh. And they would as they passed out this the leaflets and the little postcards, they would be addressed to that mailbox in the town. So they felt that was the nearest thing to their own office. And then, of course, the guy that was in charge, the committeeman, the head committeeman, would have the key to that, and he would gather them up once in a while and put them all in a big envelope and send them to Caesar in Delano. And the reason that he couldn't wait any later than September the 30th for that valley-wide organizing meeting to set up the NFWA was because by then he was almost completely out of funds, and he knew that if he put it off very many months longer, he just wouldn't be able to exist, you know. He was just so short of funds all the time. And so he had to call them all together, and he had, because he had a plan to present to them in addition to the other, or not in addition, but a plan, the most important plan of all, which was the burial fund or the death benefit plan, which would cost, as he found, had found out, he investigated the whole thing, about something like $1.50 a month per family, per farm worker family, to give benefits of $1,000 if the breadwinner of the family, the man, died, $500 if the woman died, $250 if each of the children died. And then what he figured was that if he could get as much as $350 from each farm worker, you see, then there would be $1.50 to pay for the insurance and the rest of it to pay for his salary and Dolores' salary. And perhaps a little bit for Manuel, although that was asking too much. Manuel was living off of Caesar. And so that then had to be before.